From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The state's top medical officer is headed to a trial on charges related to the Flint water crisis.
Involuntary manslaughter, misconduct in office, obstruction of justice, and lying to a peace officer.
Is Governor Snyder going to wheel and deal to get his priorities passed before his term is up?
The governor is, frankly, in an incredibly powerful spot right now because of the aggressiveness of the legislature in this lame duck session.
Some police agencies are training officers to better assess emergency calls without the use of force.
They start to see that this is really a crisis event, and we treat it as a medical issue.
And you've heard about hot buttered rum, right?
I am a sucker for clever wordplay, so when I came across a recipe for hot butternut rum, I had to make it.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In Genesee County earlier today, a judge ruled that a jury trial should be held to determine whether the state of Michigan's chief medical officer is guilty of involuntary manslaughter. Joining me now is my Michigan Radio colleague, Steve Carmody. Steve, you were in the courtroom this morning. What charges does Dr. Eden Wells face?
Well, she'll face involuntary manslaughter, misconduct in office, obstruction of justice, and lying to a peace officer, all of this connected to her time as Michigan's chief medical executive.
Yeah, remind us what the circumstances were that led to these charges.
The charges are related to the Flint water crisis and specifically to the Legionnaire's disease outbreak that took place at the same time. There is some disagreement among experts as to whether the water switch is related to the Legionnaire's disease outbreak. But during the outbreak, at least a dozen people died and dozens of others became very sick with Legionnaire's disease, which is a pneumonia-like illness. And the prosecution says that Wells and other state officials, including State Health Department Director Nick Lyon, should have done more to alert the public to the problem, but the word about the extent of the outbreak didn't come out until well after many people had died, including at least one gentleman who specifically the prosecution has filed the involuntary manslaughter charge against Wells.
What does Dr. Wells' defense attorney say?
Well, the defense attorneys say that essentially she is innocent of the charges that are against her, and they plan to continue to fight as this case moves from district court to the circuit court level where the trial will take place. They basically say it was her responsibility to advise the health director and advise the governor, but it was not necessarily her responsibility as state medical executive to issue a public alert that there was an outbreak.
I read an article by Ron Fonger in MLive saying that the judge was warning everybody, hey, this doesn't mean guilty or not. That's not what this preliminary hearing is about. But that preliminary examination went on for months. Why did it take so long to determine whether there was probable cause to go forward?
Well, prosecutor Todd Flood, who's the special counsel who's been in charge of all the Flint water crisis investigations and prosecutions, he has been painstakingly building his case, sort of putting pebbles on the pile until you can connect all the dots and you have a large enough amount of evidence to be able to say this indicates that there is a crime that's been committed and it was likely committed by this person. The judge heard from 18 witnesses, thousands and thousands of reams of evidence went through the courtroom, and the judge made it very clear in the decision he was announcing today that there was conflicting evidence and testimony that was presented, but he felt that enough evidence had been presented that warranted taking this to trial and allowing a jury to hear that same evidence and decide for itself whether there is a preponderance of evidence that proves beyond a reasonable doubt that Dr. Wells is guilty. So he wanted to make it clear this was about there's enough evidence, but it should eventually be up to a jury to decide.
Well, let's get the politics part of this involved, because on the campaign trail, Attorney General-elect Dana Nessel has been critical of how Attorney General Bill Schuette went about this investigation. Now that a trial has been scheduled, she'll inherit that. Does anybody have any idea what happens next?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a question we tried to ask of Special Counsel Flood, who was there today, but he left immediately at the end of the proceeding and declined to take any questions about his status as special counsel. And the Assistant Attorney General, who did stay and talk to reporters about the judge's decision, declined to comment about what the new Attorney General may do with the leadership of this investigation. And even the defense attorney said that they didn't want to comment on that as well.
Steve Carmody, who seems to be everywhere all the time. He was in Genesee County Court this morning where the state of Michigan's top doctor, Eden Wells, was bound over for trial. Thanks, Steve.
You're welcome.
The administration of President Donald Trump has proposed a new rule being called the public charge rule. Basically, it would be tougher to be granted legal residence if an immigrant was likely to receive some kind of government welfare. Immigrants' rights organizations all across the nation are calling on people to comment on the proposal by Monday. Steve DeBachman is with Global Detroit, a group which works with businesses who need talent the domestic workforce cannot provide. So what's your concern about the public charge proposal?
Yeah, well, it's much broader than that description of public charge. The rule is actually much broader as being proposed. So this is a rarely used piece of existing immigration law that is fairly obscure. And it has traditionally only been used in very rare circumstances when somebody who is elderly or infirm and has no known support system is coming to the United States. And what this rule will do would literally... steroids is not the appropriate term of how much growth we're talking about. We're talking about a proposal that would impact 22 million legal U.S. residents and 9 million of those being U.S.-born citizen children. And it would, in addition to looking at health care benefits via Medicaid and Medicare Part D, food stamps and housing, not only getting direct subsidies, and these are only people who have been here for more than 5 years who can even get these subsidies, or who were born here. But it would include really an all facts and circumstances based on their income. So the only people not subject now under immigration law, under this proposed rule, would be like a family of four earning more than $65,000 a year. So this is... really an underhanded and sort of obscure way in which the Trump administration is trying to curb not illegal immigration, but legal migration. And it would apply not just to new visa applicants, but it would apply to any change in status requests, as well as anybody applying for a green card.
There are these moral questions that we're not going to try to get into today, but I'm wondering, what are the economic implications of this proposal for businesses in Michigan and Detroit?
The proposed public charge rule would really devastate the Michigan economy in a number of ways. Probably the easiest to understand is our workforce and our competitiveness. So with unemployment in the state of Michigan around 4%, we're finding that employers need more talent, more staff to compete. And that hits a whole number of industries. It includes our service sector, our construction industry, agriculture, natural resources, manufacturing, and healthcare, as well as obviously high tech. The areas in which on workforce this would have the most significant impact in Michigan is in agriculture, where 20 to 30% of all our crop production workers are immigrants, in natural resources, where 8% of our workforce are immigrants, as well as our service industries, construction, and healthcare. And our fear is that as 325,000 legal Michigan residents, 190,000 of whom are immigrants and about 135,000 of them are U.S.-born children to those immigrants, will be subject to this rule, that could impact the ability to get the workforce we need. We are a rapidly aging state. We don't do well at attracting new residents from other states to our community and have really relied on immigrants to create the workforce we need for the 21st century.
Why, though, does it make economic sense to accept immigrants who, as the Trump administration says, are going to be needing housing assistance or food assistance or some of the other assistance that you can get from the government? What's the dollars and cents argument for the nation?
So, I mean, first of all, as I said, the rule is much broader than that. So no new immigrant is even eligible for these kinds of benefits for 5 years, but their visa tomorrow could be rejected because we believe them to be someone who may one day need to be eligible. Take my grandfather, for example, Morris Tabachman, when he came from Poland. Now, he ended up creating a very middle-class lifestyle for himself, but at the point of entry, if you looked at his skill set without having a high school education, without speaking English, you would have rejected him under this public charge rule. The Tabachman family has been a part of the Michigan economy for a century now, and we've been huge job creators and contributors, and I think that this rule is going to shut out people like my family, and it's going to hurt our country and hurt our community going forward. But secondly, the rule, as I said, extends to the children, the U.S. citizen children of some of these migrants. So some of the industries I mentioned, the service sector, restaurants, food production, these are jobs that pay such low wages that the children of these working immigrants are eligible for food stamps because they're U.S.-born citizens. And this is going to put immigrants in the untenable position of having to choose to access food stamps, to get a housing subsidy, to put their kids in Medicaid for which they may qualify while they continue to work our fields and grow food for our communities or work in our restaurants or work on construction sites. They're going to have to choose between providing for their children and their future status here as a legal resident.
The federal government has opened an opportunity for anyone to comment on the inadmissibility on public charge rule. Does commenting on something like this really make a difference?
Absolutely, it can make a difference. We know that already there's over 100,000 comments that have been filed. In fact, early versions of this rule that were leaked, which were much broader, have already been curtailed because of some of the blowback that industry and businesses have weighed in. We know that the Trump administration believes it's moving forward on immigration policy to create economic growth and jobs in this country, but their approach has been absolutely the opposite of what creates economic growth and jobs. And so we need businesses to weigh in. We need chambers of commerce to weigh in, and we need employers to weigh in about how this rule in particular is way too overbroad and is going to deprive us of our workforce. It's going to just not give us the kind of spending dollars we need in our communities and is going to cost the American economy.
Steve Tabachman is with Global Detroit. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks, Lester.
Coming up, with an aggressive Republican lame duck agenda in full swing, all eyes will turn to outgoing Governor Rick Snyder.
The governor can do the right thing because he has the power and he has nothing to lose.
We'll talk about what these next few weeks will mean for Governor Snyder's legacy. That's in about 5 minutes here on Stateside. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Horrific school shootings in Parkland, Florida, and Santa Fe, Texas this year have changed the conversation about school safety in Michigan. The Michigan legislature appropriated $25 million in grants for school safety this year. That's up from just $2 million in grants in the 2017 budget. The Michigan State Police administers the grant, and it just issued this year's list of recipients. Among the top grantees is Ann Arbor Public Schools, which got nearly $1 million. And joining us now is superintendent of that district, Janice Swift.
Hi, Lester.
So before we get started on the money or your plans, I was wondering, when you were planning your career in education, did you ever think that hardening a school to prevent someone from coming in and killing your students and faculty would be part of your duties?
You know, Lester, it is a shock that we're in that place. I taught school about 45 miles up the road from Columbine, so I'm afraid that did become a part of our career on that very day.
Ann Arbor Schools got a little more than $956,000 for school safety. How will you use that money?
We are very grateful to have received almost $1 million in grant money for the specific use of student safety. And so we're looking now at an emergency platform where teachers can get their emergency direction right from their cell phone. And so that's one part. Another part is to really upgrade our public announcement announcement systems in all of our schools, and then a few other odds and ends that will really help, as you say, secure the school.
Yeah, I was wondering, you know, some of your buildings are older than others. What are some of the challenges to retrofitting an older building?
Exactly. You know, Ann Arbor's average building age is 63 years, and that certainly was a long time before we had to start thinking about school in the way we do now. So we are looking at every upgrade to really ensure that we have that visitor management system, that we know who's coming in the building. That's an important part of what we do, and just a number of functions around the physical property of a school.
Yeah, it's interesting because usually it was built for access for kids coming in all kinds of doors, and now we have to restrict that access. Are some of your buildings more of a challenge than others?
They are. You know, especially, like you say, the number of doors. I think our comprehensive high schools, the three of them, have over 100 doors coming in and out of the building. That's normal in a building, but it makes it more complicated.
Where do you go for expertise about securing a school?
Well, we have been partnering with a safety and security consulting company to really bring a fresh set of eyes in to every single one of our buildings and give us a plan for ensuring that that building is as safe as it can be.
You've got these upgrades going on. How do you talk to students, particularly the younger ones, about what's happening and why?
Very good. Well, you know, Lester, our number one priority in running our schools is to keep our students safe. That priority comes even before our critical mission of teaching and learning. And so as we work with our students, we work on a developmentally appropriate level at each level of their development on how to understand student safety. Our teachers are masterful. So at the lower elementary grades, they're going to think about it in terms of staying together, keeping each other safe, staying within visibility of the teacher. You know, that context will be a little different than it is on a high school level, where our students are plugged into the news, they know exactly what's going on, and they're pressing us with questions and wanting answers.
According to the Detroit News, there were 407 applications from schools asking for $69 million in help. As I mentioned, there was $25 million available. Did Ann Arbor get everything it needs, or will the district will be asking for more help in the future?
It will be wonderful to get more help in the future. Lester, we are working through a phased process. And, you know, the number one thing we want to do is to give some peace of mind to students and to the teachers and staff who care for them every day.
I'm guessing there are going to be hundreds of other schools get their new money before you get more.
Exactly. I imagine so, and we understand that.
Yes. So you feel better about this process? You feel better, a little like you're on your way to being safer?
We feel like we have a good plan in place, and we want to continue to enhance that plan as we move forward and as technology improves our ability to do so.
Dr. Janice Swift is the superintendent of the Ann Arbor Public Schools. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Lester.
The pundits are asking, is Governor Rick Snyder getting ready to play hardball to get what he wants from this lame duck legislature? Here to talk about that now are our Friday commentators, Gilda Jacobs, the president and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy and a former Democratic member of the Senate, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican majority leader in the Michigan Senate. Nolan Finley of the Detroit News and Zach Gorchell of Gong Whir are both indicating Governor Snyder has some things he wants to get done before he's out of office, and the Republican-led legislature is not going to get everything it wants if it doesn't strike some deals with Snyder. Ken, the governor wants to implement fees on garbage and water to help clean up pollution and to fix water pipes and sewer lines. Those are fees. The Republican legislators say fees are taxes, and they're not going to raise taxes. So where does that leave things?
Well, the governor is, frankly, in an incredibly, I think, powerful spot right now because of the aggressiveness of the legislature in this lame duck session. You know, he's got a potential. If you look at all these issues, including his priorities, he's got the potential to make an impact on the future that, you know, is almost as much as he's done in his 8 years, really. And that's due to the aggressiveness of the lame duck. Now, you know, it's not been his style to be particularly confrontational. But, you know, if he chooses to take that path, you know, I think he's in a good spot to try to get his what apparently is his top priority, the environmental protection fees. But he's got to decide how confrontational he's willing to be.
About those fees, with Detroit residents and Flint residents having a hard time paying for their water bills already, is a fee on water the best way to raise money for fixing water and sewer lines? What do you think, Ken?
Well, the answer is yes. I mean, when it comes to environmental cleanup and repairing our drinking water infrastructure, it's going to take revenue. It's going to take money. And that's fees or taxes. So there's no question about it. Now, these are fees, meaning they're sort of user fees. And you could take that approach or you could take sort of the general tax approach. But regardless, it's going to take revenue. And I think everybody understands that. But the Republicans are reluctant to raise taxes and to raise fees.
Gilda, these landfill fees the governor wants for garbage, right now it currently costs 39 cents per ton of garbage to dump in a landfill, which is far, far below what the other states charge as a what they call a tipping fee. The governor wants to raise it to $3.75 a ton to clean up 3,000 heavily polluted areas. That basically comes out to about $4 per garbage customer per year. What do you think of that?
Well, that is such a modest fee or tax, if you want to use that lens. I think the people that live in Michigan, they want to have an environment that's safe for them and their kids. I think this is such a modest increase, as well as the water fees as well. We can get into that. You know, I think that for Republicans to have this, you know, no tax stance, when in their own communities, they're having these same environmental problems, you know, is really wrong. The environment, you know, clean water without lead, these are nonpartisan issues. And I think that the people in Michigan are really concerned about the communities that they're raising their families in. So I think that the people of Michigan are not going to be upset with these fees. I think they're going to happily pay them if it means that it's a better place for them to be in their communities and to raise their kids.
Gil, I'm kind of interested in this history. Why has Michigan kept its so-called tipping fee at 39 cents per ton? I mean, doesn't that just simply invite other states and Canada to use Michigan as their dumping grounds?
And it's exactly what's happened over the years. So I'm not even sure what the history of this is, other than, you know, there has been a sort of no tax increase mentality for the last, you know, at least 8 years and even going further back than that. So, you know, again, I think that, and, you know, if you take a look at bond proposals that were all passed all around the state last time, people really care about their community. And they really, I don't believe, are going to be upset with this tipping fee increase.
Ken, Governor Snyder wants a utility tunnel to be constructed under the Straits of Mackinac to house the Enbridge Line 5 oil and gas pipelines and other utility lines. What do you think of his bargaining position with the legislature on that?
Well, I think the legislature, the Republican legislature, wants to do it as well. I don't think that's an issue that where, you know, it's the governor's priority, but not a priority of the majority party in the legislature. I think that there's common ground there. I don't see that as much of a bargaining chip, if you will. I mean, it's going to be other issues that the legislature is passing relative to the environmental protection fees. I think that's kind of the standoff right now from a kind of governor Republican majority legislature perspective.
Yeah, I want to get to some of those other environmental issues that the legislature is dealing with. But Gilda, most people do not like the potential risk of Line 5 sitting on the bottom of the straits. Are the people going to be satisfied with Line 5 under the straits?
Probably not. And I know there's some discussion of, like, if this is taken care of now, this sort of takes pressure off of the new administration for doing something. You know, I think there's a sort of a political lens you can take a look at this with, and also a pragmatic lens if you were the governor in terms of what is your high priority. So I'm not, knowing that the governor really wants this, you know, it's kind of all up for grabs right now.
There are several bills that would limit protections for wetlands, for trees, limit the DEQ's use of science to determine limits on pollutants such as PFAS chemicals and other threats to the environment. Ken, how do you think the governor will deal with what some believe is the biggest attack on Michigan's environment in decades?
Well, it's an open question in terms of his position on these bills and what he's going to do. I mean, once again, I think this is one of the factors that I would say puts him in a uniquely powerful spot here in the last couple of weeks of the session, because if the legislature proceeds to adopt these and put them on his desk, he's just in an enormously, I think, powerful spot to say, look, I'm just going to veto these. Or he could say, you know, I might sign some of these, but I've got some priorities too. I think it's really going to come down to what path or what style or how confrontational and how aggressive he wants to use his veto pen.
Gilda, Governor Snyder has a mixed record on environmental issues. How do you think he'll react to some of this legislation that will likely end up on his desk?
You know, I really have to agree with Ken. He has an ability to really work on his legacy going forward. So, you know, I think this comes down to him doing a lot of soul searching and deciding what kind of Michigan he wants to leave for, you know, our Michiganders for years to come. You know, the environmental issues, it's more than just deregulation. It's what kind of state do we want to live in? And the ball really is in his court right now. I believe the governor has everything to gain and nothing to lose by vetoing some of these very onerous bills that he's going to have on his desk, whether they're environmental bills and we've talked before about minimum wage and earned sick time. You know, there's really a chance for him to really shine up his legacy a bit.
Yeah, besides these environmental issues and the things you just talked about, there's also this power grab by the Republican legislators that would diminish the powers of the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, and the governor as the Democrats are about to take all those executive offices. We have basically kind of had this conventional wisdom that Governor Snyder will be known for the Flint water crisis and for tax restructuring, but I'm wondering what kind of effect will the governor's reactions to these bills come out of this lame duck session? You've both mentioned this could affect his legacy as a governor. Ken?
Well, it would be an exaggeration for me to say that within a few hours of deciding whether to sign or veto a bunch of these bills, he's going to have as much impact as he had in his 8 years as governor. That's an exaggeration. But it kind of makes the point he's going to have, within a few hours of signing or vetoing these bills, an enormous impact on the future of Michigan. And it is going to be incredibly interesting, I think, to see how he proceeds with it. You know, there's a provision in the Michigan Constitution called the pocket veto, where at the end of a session, if he just doesn't sign or veto a bill, it doesn't become law because the legislature has adjourned. And you might see some of that pocket veto exercised here.
Gilda, what do you think? How is this going to affect his legacy overall?
Well, again, I totally agree with Ken on this.
Well, Ken's a smart guy. I mean, it's easy to agree with him, right?
Yeah, he really is. I think the governor is going to care about the kind of state that he is leaving. You know, we're seeing this power grab nationally. And, you know, it is a very deliberate action that the Republicans are doing here as well as in other states. You know, I am sure if he thinks about, would he have liked this to have happened to him when he was elected? No, you know, no way. You know, we have a system in our state that when you win, you know, you win. And it's kind of, to me, very undemocratic of the legislature to have these bills. I think it's really, you know, in the long run, going to re-energize the folks that came out in the last election, because they already think that the system is rigged. And, you know, again, I think the governor can do the right thing because he has the power and he has nothing to lose.
I just want to make an observation based on what Gilda just said. You know, when you're in the position that Governor Snyder is in, he's in his last few days of being governor. He's probably not going to run for office again. He's not subject to political pressures at all. He can be totally comfortable in his own skin in terms of what he does with all these bills. Now, he's sort of a pro-business guy. So, you know, on the business side, you know, he might look favorably upon things like the amendments to minimum wage or the amendments to the sick leave law. I don't know. But he's got the luxury of just being true to himself. And I think whatever happens here, that's what you're going to see.
Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. Gilda Jacobs is a former Democratic legislator. Thanks for your insight.
Have a great day.
Thanks, Lester.
How might a police officer respond to someone in crisis?
It's easy to put people in handcuffs. It's easy to drop them off at the jail. It's really, really hard to connect with someone on a personal level and work them through a crisis and get them to a safe location. But that is some of the most rewarding work we do.
Best practices for responding to mental health crises. That's next on Stateside. Plus, to kick off the weekend, a cocktail recipe to help you use that leftover decorative gourd. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Perhaps you've heard news stories about police arriving on the scene and mistaking someone with autism or a mental illness as being on drugs or being a threat to people or even the police themselves. Sometimes that story ends very badly. Rafael Diaz is training police officers to recognize and understand how to deal with those sorts of crises related to mental health. Diaz is executive lieutenant of Kalamazoo Public Safety. Kalamazoo was the first city in Michigan to bring crisis intervention team programs in. Rafael Diaz joins us now. So let's go beyond my basic description here. What is a crisis intervention team?
A crisis intervention team is really two things. It's interoperability between agencies within the community that law enforcement plugs into. So you're connecting community mental health services, local service providers, hospitals, those that have crisis treatment facilities, and all of your law enforcement agencies, in addition to the prosecutor's office and the court system. So you build the relationships within those so that as you encounter people in crisis, you can route them appropriately for the best treatment there is. It's one of those things that after you establish those relationships, then you can start training the staff, those people who are going to go out and encounter those folks in crisis, the police officers, the first responders. And what they then do is start to learn to recognize the signs and symptoms of folks who are mentally ill, and they start to see what it is that drives their behavior. Sometimes it can be characterized as criminal conduct, either assaultive or something else. But through training and through education and scenarios that we use in the training, they start to detect, I guess, the different cues or indicators where they start to see that this is really a crisis event and we treat it as a medical issue and get that person the help that they need.
Let's drill down a little bit into some like logistic things. Do you train only police?
The work that I do in Kalamazoo as the executive lieutenant of the training division is to provide training for law enforcement only. I do have a company that I bring that same training to other jurisdictions. And so I've worked with agencies in Oakland County, specifically the Oakland County Sheriff's Office and other jurisdictions within that county, Midland County, the Lansing Tri-County area, as well as Kent County. And Kent County has a pretty strong program going right now. But I have, with the exception of two times, only taught either law enforcement, corrections, or dispatchers in different tenets of CIT.
Now, do you train all the officers in Kalamazoo or just the members of a crisis intervention team?
Well, according to the Memphis model, and that's kind of where our program is born out of, they have a target audience of about 25% of any department. And I guess the underlying pinning is that there's a certain kind of skill set that goes along that would really incorporate the CIT skills into the patrol work, and that that's not something that everybody is really good at. I am of a mind that any officer who takes any call for service should have this training and ought to be able to be given the benefit that they can incorporate those skills, because anybody who responds to a 911 call is more than likely going to encounter someone in crisis. So I believe that it should be really 100% of an agency. And these skills really translate into not just mental health, but any form of crisis. You can find folks that have struggled, folks that have encountered different life catastrophes. It could be something what we might consider minor, a Facebook post, a slight in public. It could be a breakup. It could be a divorce. All of these things can spiral people out into different directions. And then, of course, you add in drug use or you add in mental health issues. And what you're doing is you're equipping these officers to have the skill set to engage someone in a non-criminal setting where we're dealing with that crisis event and trying to avert tragedy.
Give me an example of a right way and wrong way to deal with the same crisis involving someone with a mental health issue or other somehow is distraught.
Well, I can give you maybe a best practice. I'm not going to say that there's necessarily a wrong way. You do with what you know. And we know that at least through the police academy system, there's unfortunately only a small segment of hours that are actually dedicated to training the future law enforcement with mental health skills. I believe the actual hours are 3 out of the 594 that are required. Now, most every police academy has additional time and they add in other elements. So that's a very narrow window. But once you get on the street, what we're trying to do is get officers into the class so that they can see how to use a set of active listening skills and de-escalation skills specifically targeting this event. So I guess ideally what you want to do is you're going to use 3 general concepts when you approach a person in crisis. And it's tough to discern, honestly, initially, what drives that behavior. So we may go into thinking, because of the initial dispatch, that there's some kind of violence occurring. And of course, for public safety concerns, we need to go in there and control and manage that situation. But as we learn that there is no criminal conduct and it is something likely to be driven by mental health issues or a crisis, what we try to do is slow things down. And we're going to use time, distance, and cover. Once we realize that it's a mental health event, we slow down because we have time. And time is always on our side. By slowing things down, we can evaluate and assess the person before us. We can start to develop rapport. We can clear areas for folks that are in that area that may be in danger. And that way we can really start to delve into what's driving this event. Distance. We know that the closer we get to someone, the propensity for violence increases. Now, sometimes we have to get closer to people because there's going to be an arrest, or we need to control that person for their own safety or the safety of others around them. And so we can use distance to, one, give that person the opportunity to calm themselves. Crisis events can be fueled, and when you have people who have guns, who have badges, who exercise authority, that sometimes can spark additional conflict. And by using distance, giving some more space, we can let that person feel more at ease as we develop rapport. And then the last part is cover. Not knowing whether there's arms and things like that, we can stay a ways away from the person, but we can also position ourselves in such a way that there are barriers between us. And that improves the safety for us, and then that also means that our options for responding to perceived threats goes down, because if they're farther away and I have cover, then what they could potentially do to me is lessened. That means that I can be more comfortable in my approach and the discussion that I have, and I can really focus on developing rapport and communicating with that person. And then as a part of cover is making sure that you have officers there that can provide you with backup. So if I go to a crisis event and I'm by myself, it's a much different rubric, if you will. My decision-making is based on what I can do as a single person. But if I'm going to have backup, then I know that I can focus more on communicating while my partner is focused on my safety and the safety of others around there. See, it takes a little bit for a CIT officer to really engage someone. You really have to focus and listen. And listening, active listening skills, developing rapport, takes a lot of energy and a lot of focus. And so as a CIT officer starts to delve into what is going on with this person and trying to build that relationship so we can have a peaceful resolution, it means that in some regard you're going to let your guard down a little bit. And that's why having a cover officer with you who can be managing the safety side will allow you then to focus more on those concerns. And by breaking that officer response into two different areas of responsibility, it means that we usually end up coming with a pretty darn good resolution. And I've seen it in a number of instances with CIT-trained officers who have used time, distance, and cover and gotten resolutions where they say at the end, you know, had I not had this training, I would have had to take a different approach because I didn't understand what I was facing.
Once you've done crisis intervention team training, how do you tell whether the training is working in the street? How do you track or measure success?
Well, I can tell you that I myself am not particularly skilled in the area of gathering data. But a lot of our work that we have done has been grant funded in part through the Governor's Council on Jail Diversion. And so what they have done is partnered with Michigan State University, and they have gathered anecdotal data from different agencies and are working on a project to kind of distill down what those numbers are. Other jurisdictions throughout the country have done other assessments, and typically they find that CIT program reduces the probability of violence. The number of injuries to officers goes down. The number of injuries to the person in crisis goes down. And, you know, there's a huge benefit to society there if you don't have to use physical force. Obviously, you know, for the family that's witnessing this event, for the person in crisis, for the officer. And I'll tell you that one of the things that you can't put a number on, but the discussions that I have with CIT-trained officers is that I feel better about my interaction because I feel like I'm actually doing something to address the problem. It's easy to put people in handcuffs. It's easy to drop them off at the jail. It's really, really hard to connect with someone on a personal level and work them through a crisis and get them to a safe location. So, but that is some of the most rewarding work we do.
You've given a lot of really good examples about why the crisis intervention team program is helpful to the community. But not to be crass, does this save a community dollars and cents in the long run?
Oh, certainly I do believe so. Let's just talk about litigation. So if you're going to have suits as the result of violence, physical force used by an officer, those cost communities millions of dollars. And without training, there are times when you look at an event and go, did it need to go that way? Well, in that instance, it did. But maybe with some training, we could have changed that outcome. And I think that if you look at larger agencies that have those statistical numbers to support it, what they end up showing is that force goes down. And as force goes down, complaints go down, relationships with the community improve. The feeling that when I call, I'm going to have my problem addressed in a safe fashion. When someone comes into jail as opposed to, let's say, a crisis treatment facility where they can receive mental health treatment, the sheriff's staff must provide for the safety and care of that individual while in custody for what often might be something like an R&O or a minor battery where maybe there was no injury, things like that, different things that we can divert. And so while they're in custody, mind you, they need mental health treatment. And so that mental health treatment has to occur within that correctional facility. So it's at great expense to any sheriff's office that's responsible for housing people. So what you look at is if we get the person the treatment and care that they need and they don't have to spend a day in jail for their behavior, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not going to have charges brought against them. But then the prosecutor's office has the ability to look at what drove that conduct and decide whether charges are appropriate. And then you couple that with the court system where they have mental health courts. Someone can be brought in through the mental health court system and then directed to treatment. So what you're doing is you're kind of cutting out the jail aspect, getting them the medical care that they need to stabilize themselves and to move forward. Not to say that you're, you know, dismissing any of the conduct that might have gone along with it. We're just looking at it in a holistic approach. And I liken it a lot to when someone has a diabetic emergency. So someone who has suffering from a diabetic emergency and the sugar is out of control, they may often appear to be intoxicated, they may be erratic, they may be violent, and all of those things go on. I don't think that you could ask anybody who said that they were having a diabetic emergency that the first thing that we should do is bring them to the county jail and lock them up for the weekend, because that's not going to solve the problem. The problem is that they're having a medical crisis. And when we talk about mental health crisis, I want to rephrase that and really say that it is a medical event. They need medical care. And that kind of medical care is mental health. And so long as we can do safely and redirect that person to a care facility where they can receive treatment, that's the best course for them getting stable in the long run. That's going to reduce calls for service. That's going to reduce lawsuits for use of force issues. That's going to help the family that has to deal with that family member instead of working with the criminal justice system, which at times can be difficult to do so. We're working with the mental health system that's trying to, you know, stabilize folks in the community, especially when they suffer from severe and persistent mental illnesses.
Rafael Diaz is Executive Lieutenant of Kalamazoo Public Safety. He brought crisis intervention team training to Michigan. Thanks very much.
I appreciate it. Have a great day.
It's Friday. What do you think? Want to go grab a drink?
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
It is cold outside.
It sure is.
Well, it's nice to see you're making up a hot drink today.
I am. So one of the most popular drinks that I teach in my classes is hot buttered rum. And people love that. But I am a sucker for clever wordplay, so when I came across a recipe for hot butternut rum, I had to make it.
Oh, is that the paste-like stuff that I see in the bowl?
Yes, so that is a spiced squash butter. And it has butternut squash puree, sugar, spices, and butter.
That really smells good from here. How do you make this?
Like any hot toddy, it starts from a base of a hot liquid, and sometimes that's hot water, but in this case, it's an Earl Grey tea. So that's going to bring some flavor to the drink, and I'm using 3 ounces of that, and then about 2 tablespoons of this squash butter, and I mix those together to get that squash butter nice and dissolved into the hot liquid. Then I top it off with 1.5 ounces of rum. We're using the freshwater barrel-aged rum from New Holland Distillery, and then 1/4 ounce of something called Velvet Falernum, which is a spice liqueur that's used in tiki drinks, has a little clove, ginger, those kinds of island spices.
Doesn't sound like a beach drink at all to me.
Not at all. We're just using the falernum for its spice notes. So I just add those in after I've got that squash butter nice and melted. I just add that in and stir it all together. And then you want to drink it while it's still hot in your favorite mug.
And it doesn't take time at all to make this.
No, the time is up front in making your squash butter, which is super fast and easy in your food processor. And we'll have the recipe for that on the Michigan Radio site. Of course, you do have to wait, you know, 3 minutes for your tea to brew.
Well, let me see what this tastes like. Wow. I like it. I can say that I've never tasted anything quite like that before. It's not like any of the other hot toddies we've tried on the show.
No, and we haven't made hot buttered rum for a segment before. It has a long history in America. Nobody really knows who was the first person to put butter in a drink and why you would do that. But in the 1939 Gun Club drink book, author Charles Brown says it's only there to lubricate your mustache.
Well, we're both in trouble there.
That's right. I have no mustache. So I just really enjoy the richness that it adds to the drink. And these hot butter rums probably sprung up on the East Coast of the United States. And you could see that if you're facing down a nor'easter, having something really rich, warm, fortifying with that snow heading your way would be really nice.
But this is not just hot buttered rum.
That's right. It's hot butternut rum. So we've got that squash puree in there. We've talked a lot on Cheers about how I like to use seasonal ingredients. And so squash isn't an ingredient that gets incorporated into cocktails very often, but I really like what it brings to this drink.
Working that Michigan produce into a drink anytime you can, aren't you?
I will take any excuse to go to the farmer's market.
Well, cheers.
Cheers.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Rusty Brock, who's been really cheery today. I'm suspicious. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Joy Horan, and Natalie Brennan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.